Oh, yeah, thanks for showing off on my second talk. I was here at the Perimeter Institute, and I thought I'm not allowed to not to talk about entanglement entropy. So today I'll be talking about entanglement entropy from thermodynamic entropy in one higher dimension. This is work partly in collaboration with Homer Reid of MIT, and this is based on these two papers. Okay, I don't think I have to advertise entanglement, but let me do it anyways. What is entanglement? This is probably the most quantum phenomenon of quantum mechanics. The fundamental property that we cannot factorize the set of a system to a set of its subsystems. But more generally, the set of a system is a superposition of, let's say, some state describing subsystem A times another wave function describing the rest of the system, plus some other state chi A times chi A tilde. And if this is the case, then A and A tilde are entangled with each other. But why do we care about entanglement? Entanglement has many applications, not only in quantum information, but also in the high energy physics and black holes. In fact, we can use properties of entanglement to prove or disprove certain things about the physics of black holes. In condensed matter physics, it also has many applications. We can use entanglement entropy as a diagnosis to find properties of quantum phase transitions. To this list, we should also add atomic, molecular, and optical physics, where we can create and entangle a few atoms, photons, and quantum dots. So the wide range of applications of entanglement has led to the so-called entanglement frontier. Okay, so sometimes we don't know about part of the system, or we just don't have access to its degrees of freedom, so we can trace out those degrees of freedom to find a mixed state, the density matrix, for the subsystem of interest. So there are many different measures of entanglement. Probably the most popular one is the von Neumann entanglement entropy, which is defined by trace rho like rho. So if A and A tilde are not entangled with each other, this quantity would be zero, but otherwise it's some positive finite value which quantifies our lack of knowledge about the system. Let me also say a word about entanglement entropy versus thermodynamic entropy. Imagine that we have a system in thermal contact with some bath at finite temperature. So in this case, the entanglement entropy of the whole system is basically just identical to thermodynamic entropy. But more generally, these two quantities are just completely different. For one thing, thermodynamic entropy is extensive. So if we double the size of the system, thermodynamic entropy would be 2 times larger. But if we have a whole system in a pure state, the entanglement entropy of the whole system would be zero. But if we cut it into halves, generically, we have some non-zero entanglement entropy for only one half of the system. So if you want, this is sort of the opposite of being extensive. By the way, please feel free to ask me questions at any point. OK, so as I said, sometimes we don't have access to some degrees of freedom in the system. So we can describe the rest of the system by the density matrix. And our lack of knowledge is basically quantified in terms of the entanglement entropy. So from this, we only have partial information about the state of the whole system. But sometimes we do actually have access to the whole system. We might even know what the state of the system is. And then we may want to ask what is the density matrix of a subsystem. We want to make just some arbitrary partition in the system and then ask what is the reduced density matrix and what is the entanglement entropy. And surprisingly, even when we know what the state of the system is exactly, it's not so easy to quantify the density matrix and the entanglement entropy of part of a system. So I'll be talking more about this. But sometimes we don't really actually know what the state, this could be a many-body system, so we don't know what the many-body phase of the system is. So we use, if you want, our lack of information in entanglement entropy to actually gain more information about the system. So we can make various cuts in the system, compute entanglement entropy, and that would give us a lot of information about the system and about the underlying state of the system. So let me give you a few examples. So perhaps the most famous example is 1+1-dimensional conformal field theory. So if you have a region of size L, the entanglement entropy to the leading order is proportional to the logarithm of the size of this region, but the coefficient is actually proportional to the central charge. So by looking at the entanglement entropy, we can immediately read off the central charge of the system. In fact, in the same system, if we have two disjoint regions, here shown by A and B, the information contained in entanglement entropy describes the whole information content of this conformal field theory. So this has been shown by this gentleman. Also, in higher dimensions, in a higher dimensional conformal field theory, of course, we have more options. We can make a partition like this, possibly with a corner. And the contribution of corner to the entanglement entropy, that would also give us some information about the higher dimensional CFT. Another example is a topological quantum field theory that we have to do a yet more complicated partitioning of the system. But doing that, we can gain some information about the topological characteristic of the system. OK. But what about free field theories? I mean, free field theories are really simple. All the information of the system is just contained in the two-point function. F, and if the system is translationally invariant, this is basically just given by a function of the distance between the two points. So surprisingly, finding entanglement entropy for free field theories, even for free field theories, is quite complicated. And there's been a whole lot of literature on this. I've just selected a few from the past few years that people are attempting to find entanglement entropies even in free field theories. And let me tell you why this is actually complicated. So the vacuum set of a free quantum field theory is quite simple. This is just a collection of zero modes. But we can ask more complicated questions about the system. For example, we can put boundaries in the system. And then fluctuations in the system, or zero-point modes of the system, have to rearrange themselves to respect the boundary conditions. And then, for example, if we have two boundaries here, this gives rise to an effective interaction between the two boundaries, which gives rise to the Casimir energy between the two. So while the vacuum is really simple, by asking different questions, we should actually do something more complicated. It's not always so easy. And I'm going to argue that this is not just a metaphor for entanglement, but we can actually make this connection more precise. We can actually use the technology available in Casimir energy to learn something about entanglement. So another way to look at this is that this is general, not only for free field theories. Computing entanglement entropy is in general hard because that would depend on the geometrical but also topological properties of a domain A of the system. So it has all the geometrical characteristics of this domain. And we would like to find a computational scheme that we can compute entanglement entropy, at least in some simple examples. But it would be also ideal if we can find a conceptual and pictorial way of thinking about entanglement entropy. OK, I should also mention that there are various techniques that people have used over decades, I guess, now. CFT techniques, as I mentioned before, people have used them, but these are mostly useful in 1+1 dimension. There's also the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is very powerful and quite elegant, but this also works for CFTs or massive perturbations of CFTs. So I'm not going to talk about these techniques, but rather do something quite different. OK, so with this, let me get to the outline of my talk. I'm going to start with the free field theory with or without coupling to matter. I'm going to show that entanglement is actually connected naturally to something called thermal Casimir effect. And then I'm going to consider two disjoint regions and show that the mutual information between these disjoint regions can be understood from thermodynamic entropy in one higher dimension. And I'm going to give a geometrical picture for mutual, tripartite, and so on information in terms of polymers, which are not quite a likely candidate. And then finally, I will say a few words about what can we say beyond free field theories. Is there any question at this point? OK. So it's convenient to find a representation for entanglement entropy in terms of the path integral. I think perhaps most of the audience know about this, but I will go through this anyways. So we can represent the ground state of the system by starting from some arbitrary state and evolve it for very long times. So that would project any arbitrary state which has an infinite overlap with the ground state onto the ground state. So in terms of the path integral, we have to sum over all different trajectories from time minus infinity to, let's say, some time given by tau equals zero. So the wave function of the ground state for a particular configuration given by the value of phi zero is given by all different paths which end in phi zero. And this is a field defined everywhere in the space. Now to find the density matrix, we have to put two copies of the wave function together. And let's say we're interested in the reduced density matrix of a domain A. So we have to sum over all different paths in terms of the field. But then we have to make a cut here in the domain defined by A. So right below this domain, the value of the field is set to phi zero. And right above that is given by phi zero prime. So that would actually give us the density matrix, which is a density matrix sandwiched between a configuration given by phi zero and another configuration given by phi zero prime. And using this representation, we can actually compute useful quantities. For example, we can compute the expression like this, trace of some polynomial of the density matrix. So we have to make two copies of spacetime, each copy corresponding to one factor of the density matrix. And then if you look at this, this is just a matrix multiplication. So the row component of one should be identified with the column component of the other one. In terms of this picture, that means that the value of the field right above this cut has to be identified with the value of the field right below the other cut on the other copy of the spacetime, and also in the other case. So this is just a useful representation, but this immediately gives us something like the Rényi entropy. So the Rényi entropy is defined by log trace of rho to the n, and this is a very useful quantity because it produces entanglement entropy in the limit that n goes to 1, but also it's just easier to compute because we don't have this nasty logarithm here. It's just a polynomial. And so this expression, for example, is given by the exponential of the second Rényi entropy. Okay, so let me start, as I promised, let me start with the free scalar field theory. So this is just given by this action, and in principle we can add a master, or we can even add a potential term which depends on the position. But for simplicity, let me just neglect these terms for now. And then let's compute the second Rényi entropy for this free field theory. We can make a linear combination of, this is just a convenient basis to evaluate this functional integral. We can define phi plus and phi minus by the linear combination of phi 1 and phi 2. And you can easily see that phi plus actually decouples. The two actually decouple from each other, but also phi plus becomes trivial. The cut is just invisible to phi plus. So that the contribution from phi plus is just 1. It factors out. And for phi minus, we have to compute basically the functional integral in the presence of this cut, where the boundary condition right along the cut is given by this. So as we go across the cut, it just picks up the minus value. Okay, so in this sense, we have started from the second Rényi entropy, and we have mapped it to this path integral over a space-time, and then we can think about this as sort of the free energy. So this is perhaps the simplest quantum to classical mapping, mapping that you've ever seen. On this side, we've started from a quantum system at zero temperature. And on the other side, we have a classical system. Let's normalize the temperature to 1. And then we have to compute the change of the free energy in the presence of this Hamiltonian where we impose this boundary condition. Okay, but this boundary condition is a little weird. Can we write this in terms of something which is more familiar in terms of scalar fields? And in fact, we can do this. Let me just say a word about this, that the way we can do this is that we can just symmetrize and anti-symmetrize the field in the direction of the imaginary time, and then we get an expression like this. So let me explain what this means. So here again, we are computing the second Rényi entropy of a domain A, and this maps to the change of the free energy for the following geometries. So first of all, we have to put this in one higher dimension, and then we have to impose the Dirichlet boundary condition, which sets field the value of the field to zero. We have to compute how much the free energy in this background of thermally fluctuating field is going to change by imposing this boundary condition. And we have to add to this a contribution basically from something similar, except that now we have to compute the change of free energy when the boundary condition is imposed on the complementary region at time zero. And then we have to subtract the whole thing when the whole plane at time equals zero is set to zero. The boundary condition, the value of the field is set to zero. Is there any question?
The first term and the second term?
The first term and the second term? So, okay, so this is where we just impose the boundary, the Dirichlet boundary condition only on this domain.
Oh, it's on the domain, it's not on the boundary
of the domain. It's on the whole domain. So yeah, maybe these boundaries are misleading here. So here I set the boundary condition everywhere in this domain, and here I set it everywhere in the rest of the plane at tau equals zero. Okay, I'm going to show that this immediately makes some sense at least. So first of all, if this domain A is the whole space, we can see that this just becomes whole space minus the whole, the whole plane minus the whole plane. So, and this should be the case because the state of the whole system is just a pure state. Also, it obviously has the symmetry that we would expect for entanglement entropy in a pure state. So the Rényi entropy for the region A is the same as the Rényi entropy of the complementary region A tilde. And also, we can sort of see how area law emerges in this context. So if we have, let's say, a statistical system, and if we introduce a boundary, there are contributions to the free energy, which is proportional to the volume of the system, but they don't care about the boundary. But there are also subleading terms which care about the boundary that we just placed in the system. So there would be a subleading correction to the free energy as a result of boundary, and so on. So for surface, we would get a surface contribution. If we have edges in the system, we get edge contributions, and so on and so forth. But the Rényi entropy of the system, we have to compute this. We have to sum these two contributions and subtract by this, so you can see that the volume, which in this context, volume really means the surface here. So the surface of this plus the surface of the complementary region minus the whole surface, that just becomes zero. And the leading contribution to the Rényi entropy is proportional to the area of this domain, which in this context, is the area means the perimeter of this region.
So basically, you're saying that doing this calculation is completely equivalent to doing the calculation you had before, where this domain represents a cut across which.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly equivalent. But it has a nice advantage, and I will be talking about this more. The obvious advantage is that now we're dealing with a boundary condition which is familiar to us, and we can map it from that. We can map it to some other problems that we already know how to handle. Okay. But this also makes some symmetries in the problem obvious. So this is, okay, at least this makes some sense.
Is this equivalent only for free theory or in general?
This works for free theory. Because I'm, so for one thing, I'm making this a linear combination. And if the system, if the field theory is quadratic, then the two modes, phi plus and phi minus, are decoupled from each other. But also, at this point, I'm also making an assumption because I'm symmetrizing and anti-symmetrizing with respect to the imaginary time. So I also need this to be quadratic even to go from the previous step to this step. But I'll comment to what extent we might expect something similar for interacting field theories. Good. Okay, so we can actually simplify this even further. So I told you that the Rényi entropy, the second Rényi entropy, becomes this combination. And you can see the minus sign, right? OK.
But in fact, we can simplify this even more. The last two terms can be combined to give something only in terms of a boundary condition of the domain that we started with. And that would be the Neumann boundary condition. And this comes from, if you remember electrodynamics from your undergrad or graduate courses, Babinet principle actually relates boundary condition on one surface to the complementary boundary condition on the complementary domain. But at the end of the day, what we get is for the second Rényi entropy, we get the sum of the change of the free energy. But for the two boundary conditions that we know and are familiar with in the context of a scalar field theory. Okay, so now that we have this mapping, can we compute the Rényi entropy, let's say, of a single region? And so that question would depend on the various UV cutoffs in the problem. Or I shouldn't say various. It depends on the UV cutoff in the problem. So it's ideal if we can compute something which is cutoff independent. And for that, I would like to think about, for example, mutual information or Rényi information in this context, which basically characterizes how much quantum information is shared in two different regions. So this is defined by the Rényi entropy of A plus Rényi entropy of B minus Rényi entropy of the sum of them. And of course, if the regions are very far apart from each other, this quantity would be zero, at least for this free field theory. So it gives you an idea that this would be independent of the UV cutoff. At any finite separation between the two regions, this would have some finite value, but it would only depend on the geometrical length of scale in the problem, like the separation or the size of the system, but not any cutoff. But using the map that I just told you, this becomes an expression in terms of the free energy. So to compute this, we have to compute the change of the free energy. We have to go to one higher dimension and compute the change of the free energy when we introduce these domains with certain boundary conditions, Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions. And in particular, we have to compute this combination, the change of free energy in the presence of both A and B, and then the change of free energy in the presence of individual domains A or B. And if you think about this, this is really something like Casimir energy. So first of all, it's thermal Casimir energy because we have this background of thermal fluctuations in D plus one dimensions. But also, this is an interaction energy. These last two terms, if you want, they are self-energies of these individual domains. So by computing this combination, we're actually looking at the interaction energy between the two domains as a result of thermal fluctuations in D plus one dimensions.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Are you making tau to be periodic in order to make connection with the thermal energy?
Are you asking what happens if I start at the finite temperature?
No, I'm just asking where can I see the thermal circle?
So the temperature that we started with was zero.
Okay.
On the quantum side.
Yeah, yeah.
But all of this, and I think I have a slide on this. If you start at finite temperature, then you can do almost everything that I told you so far, but it would be on a cylinder. It would be a little bit more complicated, but the same sort of conclusion also holds there. Okay, so in this sense, to compute the mutual information, or in this case, the second Rényi information, we really have to compute the thermal Casimir energy of these domains when we impose Dirichlet and Neumann boundary condition on the surfaces.
Sorry, can you say again why it's the thermal?
Oh, it's thermal because, So we start from the dimension of zero temperature, and we have to compute the change of the partition function in one higher dimension in the presence of this domain. Mm-hmm. So you could say that, okay, I may be cheating because I'm already going to one higher dimension, so maybe I should just call it a quantum rather than thermal. But the thing is that if this is really a quantum Casimir effect, if you go to one higher dimension, you have to extend, let's say you started with some regime in the presence of quantum fluctuations. If you go to one higher dimension, you have to extend that regime all the way from minus infinity to plus infinity. But this is not quite the case here. Here we don't have
you know, a region which is extended all the way from minus to plus infinity. This is here we just have a cut at time tau equals zero. So in that sense, it's just natural to call it thermal Casimir energy. Okay, so what can we learn from this? We can map this to thermal Casimir energy. What can we really do with this? So let me argue that this is really useful in a few different perspectives. Let me start from the computational advantage of this. So, I mean, the Casimir effect has been around for a long time, and people have thought about this quite a bit. And there are various ways that you can compute this. One particular powerful way to do this is in terms of the scattering theory. So in the quantum context, when we have, let's say, two objects with some boundary conditions, and we have quantum fluctuations between them in the vacuum, we can relate the Casimir energy between them to the scattering matrices of individual objects. So we can individually find the scattering matrix for each object and combine the two to find the Casimir energy between these two objects. Now, for thermal Casimir effect, where instead of quantum fluctuations, we have thermal fluctuations, we can pretty much do the same thing, except that we have to compute capacitance matrices. If you think about it, this because the capacitance matrix is really the limit of omega frequency going to zero of the scattering matrix. And if you want to see a formula, this is what I really mean by this. So this is the thermal Casimir energy is proportional to kBT because it's purely fluctuation induced. And then you have trace log of this expression. So CA and CB, they represent the capacitance matrices of A and B. And G is just the free Green's function that take you from one object and back. OK, so in this sense, the mutual information.
So that is, again, for free theory?
So far, everything is free theory. Yeah, so in this sense, the mutual information between two regions can be computed really from the capacitances of these regions once you embed them in one higher dimension. In fact, if you go, I talked about the capacitance matrices. This is where you have the two regions very close to each other. So you think about, you have to think about all multiples. But if the two regions are far from each other, this literally becomes just an expression in terms of the usual capacitance that we're used to in electrostatics. Okay, so this is nice. We can relate mutual information to capacitance from electrostatics. So let me tell you why this is useful even conceptually. So when we think about energy in general or thermal Casimir energy in this context, we can think about forces. We can just take the derivative with respect to separation. In this case, we have two regions, let's say two half plates, extended all the way to infinity, but they're also separated by distance L. So taking the derivative with respect to L, that would just define the force. Now, the force is a physical quantity, so it cannot depend on the cutoffs in the problem. It can only depend on the macroscopic length scale. So if we want to compute the force, and by force I mean really the derivative of the Rényi information, the force should just on the dimensional grounds should be proportional to kBT, should be extensive in the area, and then again on dimensional grounds it should be inversely proportional to the separation between the two to the power d. This is the spatial dimension, the number of spatial dimensions. So if we integrate this force for any dimension higher than d, we just find an area law, meaning that the mutual information would be proportional to the area divided by the separation to d minus 1. But only in one dimension, when we integrate this, we get this logarithm. So the logarithm in one dimension is really a consequence of the scaling form of the force, which really comes from a simple dimensional analysis. OK, now that we have this intuition, can we find even other configurations which give rise to a similar logarithmic behavior, even in higher dimensions? And the answer is yes. So even if we're not in one dimension, let's say we are in two spatial dimensions, and if we think about scale-free regions, which they don't have, which don't have any scale of their own, but the only scale in the problem is really the separation between these two regions, just
on the same dimensional grounds, the force should be proportional to 1 over L, the separation of these two regions. So the mutual information, even for this configuration, should be logarithmic. In fact, we can do something more. We can relate the, so the coefficient of this is universal. You remember that this is Rényi information. And by definition, it cannot depend on any cutoff. So the coefficient has to be universal. But we can, basically following this line of thought, we can immediately relate the universal coefficient that appears here to the universal coefficient that we know are associated with corners in 2 plus 1 dimensions. If you want me to be more precise, this universal coefficient actually becomes the sum of the coefficient of the logarithmic term, which is associated with the corner just for the single region A, and then we have to sum it with the other one, the contribution from the other conical singularity, and then we have to subtract this by the coefficient which arises in this geometry. This is also a conical singularity, but it's just different from just a single isolated cone. Okay, another very natural question that we can ask about mutual information is that whether it's monotonic or not. So basically, if we bring the two regions closer and closer to each other, is mutual information or Rényi information monotonically increasing, or it would be something different? And in terms of the force, this finds a very natural interpretation. Monotonic behavior of information just translates into an attractive force. And in fact, there are powerful theorems that you can use to show that the force, at least for regions which are mirror images of each other, is always attractive. So for a configuration like this, starting from large separations, as we bring the two regions closer and closer, mutual information can only increase monotonically. Okay, but if you have come here for the title of my talk, you expect me to say something about thermodynamic entropy. I talked about thermodynamic free energy, but what is the connection with thermodynamic entropy? So there's a quote by Feynman that every physicist who is any good knows 6 or 7 different representations for the same physics. So in the same spirit, let me talk about another representation of the Casimir force. And this is in terms of word lines. So to some of you, this might be familiar in terms of first quantization. To some others, maybe this is something like a string theory, except that we don't sum over word sheets, but we sum over word lines. So this is an equivalent description of the field theory that the path integral is over word lines as opposed to fields. So in this language, we have the vacuum is described by the sum of all polymers, which are basically closed loops. And to find the Casimir energy between, let's say, two surfaces, we have to count those loops which intersect both surfaces. So those which do not intersect with any of these two surfaces do not contribute to the Casimir energy. Also, those that intersect only with one surface, they also don't contribute to the Casimir energy. But we have to count the ones that intersect both surfaces. OK, but one thing about the polymers is that there is no, I mean, I call them polymers or word lines interchangeably. But what's interesting about them is that there is no energetics associated with them. We just have to sum over different configurations of polymers in order to find, let's say, the Rényi information. In this picture, we have to go to one higher dimension, and we just have to count how many polymers exist that are stretched between the two domains A and B. And this is just counting. So in that sense, this is just entropic. So the change of the free energy is really just a change of thermodynamic entropy. And we can actually even use this to prove certain things. For example, a strong subadditivity property. So this is a property of quantum systems which is actually quite difficult to prove I'm not going to prove it here. I'm just going to show that this is satisfied in this model. But in terms of polymers, this verification almost comes trivially. Okay, so there are different versions of a strong subadditivity property. A convenient form for my purposes is this, which basically says that the tripartite information, which is basically a quantity that quantifies how much information is shared between three different regions, is smaller or equal to the mutual information. Now, in terms of polymers, the mutual information or the Rényi information, I just told you that this just becomes the number of polymers that intersect both A and B. But the tripartite information becomes the equivalent of the same thing for three different regions. So we have to count polymers which intersect all A, B, and C. So obviously, this quantity is smaller than this. So this is.
So I'm confused why there is only entropy contribution. In general, there's tension to the world.
So, I mean, the way it works is that, so I haven't been very precise here. But what we do here to compute the chasm energy, we basically sum over all different configurations. There's no information about the energy, but there's just we sum over different configuration and we weight it basically by the length of the polymer.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's a tension for the.
But then, yeah, doesn't that correspond to an energy?
Okay. So what I'm saying is. It basically sum over all configurations with some lengths, let's say L, and there is. Can you actually see this? Or
can someone turn on the
light? So we have to sum over all the polymer configuration. This is weighted by the length of the polymer. And then we have to basically count what percentage of, and okay, to be even more precise, we also have to sum over the center of mass of the polymer. So this information is basically, the information that is here is just basically the information about how many polymers we have of a given size with a given center of mass coordinate. And then at this point, we have to compute an average, which just, in some sense, it tells us what percentage or what fraction of polymers of a given size and a given center of mass coordinate intersect with these two regions.
I guess my question is, why is there no Boltzmann factor? The energy that is proportional to the length.
Right. So I've considered a massless field theory, which in terms of polymers becomes something like this. If you have a massive theory, it also finds a term like this, E2 minus M squared L.
So right. Fine-tune.
No, but I mean, the conclusion of this slide also holds in this case, because what I really care about is this average. So in this average, so if you want, I actually show that the strong subadditivity property holds for each given length and each given center of mass coordinate. So this average actually, you can show that for
given length.
Yeah, for given length and a given center of mass coordinate holds. Yeah. Adiabatic, huh? Okay. Okay, so this this really becomes trivial in terms of polymers. And not only this is, I think, a nice connection, but also it gives us certain things for free. Okay, so far I talked about Gaussian theories. I don't have much to say about interacting field theories, but let me just inspire you that maybe something more general holds also for theories beyond the Gaussian theory. So for that, let's take the example of conformal field theory in 1 plus 1 dimension. And let's look at this on the quantum side that I talked about before, but also let's just compare it to the classical side. Of course, we shouldn't expect that the two would be equivalent, but we can just look what shows up in this case, in each case. So on the quantum side, we can compute the Rényi information. A useful way of writing this is in terms of the derivative of the Rényi information between two half lines or half infinite lines, which are extended all the way to infinity, but they're separated by distance L. So the derivative of the Rényi information is proportional to 1 over L, which really comes from just a dimension analysis, but the coefficient is central charge divided by 4. Okay, so this is the quantum side of the problem. Now, on the classical side, let's forget about quantum mechanics completely. Now we just put two needles or half infinite lines in a two-dimensional system at a finite temperature, and let's set temperature to 1. And let's ask, what is the force between the two lines? So this is also called critical Casimir, that you just you don't just have a free field in the vacuum, but you have an interacting field theory. And actually, it turns out that for each conformally invariant boundary condition on these lines, the force is going to be, again, proportional to 1 over L, but the coefficient is C over 8. But let me remind you that before we mapped this scalar field theory, free scalar field theory, to something in terms of Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions. So two different, by the way, conformally invariant boundary conditions for a scalar field. So in the same spirit, if we multiply this quantity by 2 for two different boundary conditions, that would give us the exact same coefficient as we had here, C over 4. So this is not meant to be proof or anything like that, but this is just an example that maybe we are on the right track to think about this kind of mapping between the quantum and the classical system. Okay, in the last few slides, let me also discuss a slightly different model. I'm not going to go through the details of this, but you might ask me if the second Rényi entropy is somehow special. And let me give another example, which I think is interesting on its own, in which case I actually compute the Feynman entropy. And I'm going to show you that the same mapping will also work in this case. So here I have a system, a combination of the free scalar field theory phi and another field psi, which is restricted to some domain, A. And so this field represents, if you want, matter. So I have some matter degrees of freedom coupled to a free scalar field. So the action for this system is given by the same action that I had for the scalar field. For the matter field on this domain, I have a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And then I also coupled the two fields. So something about this is that if you integrate out the psi field, you will actually get an action which describes, let's say, a dielectric object. So this is a genuine description of some matter coupled to some field in the background. And this somehow mimics electrodynamics. This is my very brief justification that why this is a good model for matter. But in fact, what I'm interested is rather integrating out the scalar field and finding the entanglement between matter and field in the background. And one point that I would like to mention here is that, so here I don't require, you can see that I've introduced some, you know, static degrees of freedom here. So I don't require any Lorentz symmetry, any translation symmetry. I can even add mass to these terms. So I don't usually, I don't take the symmetries that usually people take for granted to compute anything about entanglement entropy. And then it turns out that, to make sure that the expression that I'm going to compute is not going to depend on the cutoff, I would like to compute the mutual information between two different chunks of matter. So let me summarize this. We have two or fewer chunks of matter. They're coupled to some field in the background. So we have 0-point fluctuation and everything in the background going on. And then we would like to know how much the two regions are entangled with each other. And then, in fact, we can relate the mutual information, which is defined from the von Neumann entropy, to something very similar in terms of the thermal Casimir energy. So again, we have to make the same mapping, going to one higher dimension, introduce these domains. But something that would be different in this case is that we have to sum over different boundary conditions, the so-called Robin boundary conditions. It's not really important what they are. In fact, we have to sum over a whole continuum of these boundary conditions. But rather, the point that I like to emphasize here is that, again, we find the same mapping. So we're starting with a rather different model. We again find some expression in terms of thermal Casimir energy, but over different boundary conditions. Okay, and then we can compute basically using the technology which is available for thermal Casimir energy. We can compute mutual information between two different regions with different shapes, with different sizes at various separations. And we can actually find interesting properties of this. So this is, I mean, in the light of the fact that it's usually so hard to compute quantities like this, it's quite fortunate that we can find a mapping like this, which immediately allows us to compute things like this, which normally is considered to be very complicated. OK, I think I actually finished quite a bit in time. So in summary, I told you about a quantum to classical mapping that allows us to describe entanglement and entanglement entropy and information, whether mutual information or any information, in terms of thermal Casimir energy. And we can learn about properties of entanglement and information from the usual thermodynamics. We can even find a picture in terms of polymers that's useful to find properties of entanglement, such as a strong subadditivity property. And this machinery can be easily extended away from criticality when we have a finite mass, or we have external potential, which depends on the position. We can add finite temperature to the system. We can do this for free fermions or a fermionic theory at the quadratic level, which should be already interesting. But I think the most interesting question is to what extent we can extend this to interacting field theories or more general many-body systems. So thank you for your attention.
Questions? Yes.
OK, so if you consider higher Renyi entropies, does it correspond with sum over several boundary conditions?
So higher Renyi entropies would be a little bit more complicated. I'm confident that it should be possible to do something similar, but I haven't quite worked it out. Yep. But the boundary condition would be more complicated. So for one thing, if you have more, if you look at Renyi entropies of higher ranks, you can basically do the same decoupling. So here I did it in terms of phi plus and phi minus. But if you have a higher rank Renyi entropy, you have to complexify the field first, and then you have to impose some boundary condition on the complex on the complexified field. And the kind of boundary condition that you are allowed to include for a complex field would be, of course, more complicated than just Dirichlet and Neumann. So in that sense, it would be more complicated. But here also, I have these other examples that I compute the von Neumann entropy. In that case, you can see that we can map this to some other boundary conditions, not quite Dirichlet and Neumann, but some other boundary conditions that fully represent the von Neumann entropy.
Any more questions?
And actually, yeah. In regard to you, let me just show this last slide. In regard to the question that you asked previously, so if we have a finite temperature, of course, we have to put everything in a cylinder. The mapping would be slightly more complicated. So for one thing, you can see that this expression for the second Renyi entropy is no longer symmetric with respect to A and A tilde, But it really shouldn't be, because we're now at finite temperature. So I just took advantage of a brief pause. Yeah.
So is there some geometry in which using this, you know, Dirichlet or Antoine Lehmann, you know, allows you to kind of compute things more easily than in other?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, this kind of. I guess I haven't shown you examples of this. So I've actually done this. Yeah. I mean, for example, at large separation between two different regions, as I said, this is just related to capacitances of these regions. So knowing what the capacitance of a given domain is, we can immediately find out what is the mutual information between two regions at high separations. But we can also do this, so this is the other example that I've looked at. We can also look at this two half planes. So, I mean, the scattering matrix for a half plane is known. It's a little more complicated because we have to put this in one higher dimension. But from this capacitance matrix, you can actually compute basically the universal coefficient that sits at the front of this area law. And so people have computed this numerically, but you can also compute this number, the way that I do, you can even get some analytical, you know, expression for that.
So it's like 1 over the D.
Right. Yeah. And also, you can look at more complicated things. I mean, as long as you know the capacitance matrices, which are very much available, for example, you can consider exotic cases that you have one geometry inside another geometry, or you have a half plate versus a disk, or you can consider various geometries. So it depends what you're really interested in.
Can you do like say an annulus?
Yeah, sure. So one thing is that you can always do this numerically, and of course this is free field, so you can always do it numerically anyways. But you can do it numerically with other methods that are sophisticated in electrostatics and in computing capacitance matrices. But also, as long as you have some information about the electrostatics of the domain that you've considered, but again, in one higher dimension, then you know pretty much everything about the system.
So you mentioned these corner terms.
Yes.
So are you able to extract the, like there's, so the corner term, you know, has this log L, and there's some coefficient, which is
right,
a function of the actual
right
angle of opening. Are you
right
able to extract that function analytically?
I think yes. I haven't attempted, but I think there should be quite a big literature on this on the field theory side and in this Casimir context. So people have thought about this for a long time, that you have, I don't know, an isolated region with some boundary condition. And you ask what is the energy or the energy density or, I don't know, the energy momentum tensor is going to behave near these boundaries. And I would be surprised if people haven't looked at this. But I actually didn't try very hard to find the literature on this. Yeah.
Okay. There are no more questions. Let's thank Muhammad again.
Thank you.